You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you who are joining us for the very first time tonight, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here, and I think you're going to be glad as well. Now, those of you who are subscribed to the K-Files e-zine got an update today about the telephone attacks that we've been under. And this actually reaches back. It's two separate attacks. One has to do with, the problem where we have, we're talking with a guest and then someone just cuts the phone line and the guest, we have to call the guest back. I think I've got that solved as well. But then the other one has to do with a little group of guys that decided that, they were going to be like cool, you know, and just call in pranks every night. Well, I warned over and over and over that I was going to take some tough measures. I outlined what those measures would be, and they didn't believe me. And those of you who watched the show or heard the show last night know that I announced that, and I put it up on the screen, it's also on my website, and I announced, if you call a prank in when I open the phone lines, you guys keep it up, I'm going to make you famous. I'm going to put your phone number on the screen for the world to see. And therefore, since I've warned you, if you do it, you're agreeing that you want your phone number up on the screen. The investigation into that sort of culminated today. A couple of things happened. I think it's fair to say that the ground shook from here to Los Angeles and from there to Montreal and back. And I don't think that anybody in that group is going to be stupid enough to pursue this and do it again. But the same deal applies actually from now on, and that is everyone is free to call this show. If you want to talk with a guest, you want to make a comment or ask a question, but you call in and decide you're going to disrupt the show with your little pranks, I'm going to make you famous, as well as institute criminal investigation and also investigation for possible lawsuits. Now, I think we've got this one handled. The owner of the website, and, you know, I said it from the beginning, you know that, but the owner of the website, or actually the editor and publisher of the website, has been in touch with me via email. He did not know all this was going on. He apologized sincerely and took all this nonsense off the website. I informed him the result of my investigation showed that they were also using his website to plan an attack on the Colin Ferguson show, you know, the late night TV show. They also were planning an attack on that. And they absolutely didn't care if they put this website and its owner at risk. But I think it's over. And if you have been calling that number, I didn't ask you to, but please don't do that. His mom is very much on our side here. All right, we'll be back with Charles Hall right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Charles Hall. Now, he's been with us before several times, and it's always a pleasure. But for those of you who may not know Charles Hall, he is a nuclear physicist, former U.S. Air Force. He is an author. He's one of a handful of people capable of and cleared to work with the Cray supercomputers, the super secret stuff. And he's the father of the Hall photon theory. We're going to talk about that some tonight. And he's an all-around nice guy. And I can say that with confidence. I have met him and his wife personally. They are just great people. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be on your show, Kevin. Thank you for having me. I always enjoy being on your show.
It's been a while.
It's about that's true, yes.
Yeah, it's been what a year.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
As you know, I have four books, and my website is millennialhospitality.com, which viewers can go to and see a preview of my four books.
All right, that would be a good thing, too, and we'll get into talking about some of those books here in a little bit. But you, as a nuclear physicist, have come up with, and I have read it, I've read a copy of the Hall photon theory. Charles, I want to throw this at you.
Sure.
I had as my guest on this show Dr. Michio Kaku, and we were talking about his book. It's called The Physics of the Impossible. And Dr. Kaku was every once in a while would refer to the laws of physics. And he would say, well, you know, the laws of physics, as we understand it, this we would have to overcome this in order for that to happen. And he was talking about some really futuristic sort of things that in order for that to happen, we would have to be able to overcome this law or that part of a law of physics. And I said, I kind of was a little nervous when I said it, but I said, well, Dr. Kaku, there was a time when Newton's laws were considered the laws. That's the way the universe worked. And then along comes this guy, Einstein, and he proposed the general theory of relativity and the special theory of relativity. And he upset the apple cart. People ridiculed him. There were papers written about why he was wrong, and there were speeches given, and they ridiculed him. But then his theories of relativity sort of have become the laws. And I said to Dr. Kaku, I said, isn't it true that there really are no laws of physics? What we're calling laws of physics are just our current understanding of how things work, but they're not actually laws. And he said, absolutely. So what do you think? I say there are no laws of physics as far as we're concerned. There probably are, but we don't know them. There is just our current understanding of the way things work, and that changes.
I certainly agree with that. Einstein, when he was putting out his theory of relativity was really going out on a limb, and Hall photon theory, you know, says that Einstein was simply wrong on the theory of relativity. Einstein was trying to put forth the theory of relativity before physicists even understood the structure of the atom, and so, you know, it was sort of like, well, if he'd been an astronomer, he would have gone into the bathroom and watched water run down the drain and hypothesized galaxies. You know, he was so far, you know, he was really practicing a religion more than a law of physics kind of thing. Hall photon theory, and in the appendix to book 3, I have a copyrighted paper, and in the appendix of book 4, I have an expanded paper where I discuss Hall photon theory. And one of the tenets of Hall photon theory is that there are more physically real forces and more ways energy can be stored and transformed than what Einstein was aware of. And therefore, relativity is wrong because he's trying to put together a puzzle without all the pieces. And I'm happy to discuss that in greater depth.
Well, before we get into that, just also a point of interest, and I don't know if you've seen this, it just came out. A couple of scientists, I think it's at Indiana University, I'm trying to remember, but Professor Kostolesky and one of his students, I think his name was, I can't remember the student's name, but they have discovered with some sort of unconventional experimentation that the Lorentz invariant symmetry is not correct in Einstein's theory of relativity. They've been able to show that the so-called laws of physics actually can act on one body in one way and another body in a different way. And so there you don't have uniformity or symmetry in the laws of physics as described in Einstein's theories of relativity. And they were going to publish that on January the 9th, so it's pretty recent. I don't know if you've heard about that.
I appreciate your telling me that. This is the first I've heard of it, but I certainly agree with their proposition. You see, the first place that scientists went wrong was they believed that, currently when you open up a book on physics, and I have a master's degree in nuclear physics, they will say something that really isn't true, and the physicists should know it. They say that all physical phenomena can be explained using just four forces, and I know that's not right. When I was a weather observer in the U.S. Air Force back in the 60s, as I describe in my four books, the Millennial Hospitality Series, I used to watch the alien spacecraft, the tall white spacecraft. Once they powered up, I used to watch them, lift up off the ground, defying gravity. And then when they were fully powered up and surrounded by that extra force field where they looked fuzzed over, they could move a distance of like 7 miles at an average speed of more than 8,000 miles an hour. I timed them, and they could move so quickly that if you didn't happen to be looking when they started the acceleration, you'd think they just disappeared because they had left so fast. But then they could accelerate. They could go like 7 miles at that speed. They could just accelerate and stop on a dime, and then sit back down in the desert, and they were just sitting in the spacecraft as you and I are sitting in our chairs, but they could only do it when they were powered up, surrounded by that extra field. Well, that was right there I could see that you can't do that just using if you were limited to just the four force fields that Einstein knew about: gravity, electromagnetism, strong nuclear and weak nuclear. right there it was obvious to me that there had to be more force fields than what Einstein and the human physicists knew about. And the fact that they would only do it when they were powered up, that they first looked at when they were sitting out in the desert, say 3-4 miles away, if you were up close, you'd get burned. But if you, when they were powered up like that, but when they were out in the desert, they would appear to fuzz over like an egg, you know, so they'd look like a giant white fuzzy egg out there. It was obvious that that force field interacted with light. Well, the only way it can interact with light is for there to be another force field that interacts with electricity and magnetism, you see. And the only way, and that force field must be carried by light itself. So the, one of the first basic tenets of Hall photon theory is that radio waves and light waves are three fields, not just two. That there, you know, James Clerk Maxwell in 1864 said that light and radio waves were just two fields, electricity and magnetism, the electric field and the magnetic field, oscillating together in phase. But it was obvious to me that there has to be a third field associated with that oscillation. And that's what that's the first tenet of Hall photon theory. And Hall photon theory names those fields the starshine fields. And when you think, and of course, once you realize that there's a third field inside a beam of light, and that field is weakly interacting, it steers the photon. It's the one that gives the photon the property of behaving sometimes like a wave and sometimes like a particle. Once you realize that there's a third field in there, and therefore there has to be a quark that creates that field and so on, then all of a sudden you see that relativity is hopelessly incorrect. It's a mathematical parlor game, but the place where Einstein was really wrong was when he was pretending that Einstein was pretending that relativity was reality, as opposed to relativity was a mathematical approach for trying to advance physics before you knew all the parts. See, he went wrong when Einstein said, for example, that time slows down when you accelerate it, when you're traveling near the speed of light, he was hopelessly incorrect. If he had just said, that's how I'm going to treat the mathematics until we find out more about physics, then he might have been justified. But when he went that extra step and said, you couldn't travel faster than the speed of light, that because time was slowing down, then he was really off in the swamp.
All right, now you see, I've said this, and every time I say this, I do get some email. I don't get flooded with email, but I always get one or two where people try to very nice, but they try to sort of instruct me on where I'm off base here. But I have said, and I still maintain, that when people say that the speed of light is the fastest speed there is nothing faster. That is simply not true. It may be the fastest speed that has been observed, but that doesn't mean there are no other speeds beyond it. It's just the fastest one that's been observed.
You're certainly correct. And since there is a speed faster than light, it means that Einstein was wrong about time slowing down at the speed of light. It should be very obvious to physicists who think about it that Einstein was not correct on relativity. And I'll give you in the case of velocities, for example, if consider a radio wave where, according to the equations of James Clerk Maxwell of 1864, a radio wave is supposed to be an electric field vector and a magnetic field vector oscillating together in phase. Well, there comes a time in that oscillation when both field vectors are zero. You see, like for a radio wave traveling through space, like a particle of light coming from the sun traveling towards the Earth, well, there comes a time when both of those field vectors are at zero. Well, right then, if the beam of you have, since the particle still has the beam of light, the photon of light still carries energy, Planck's constant times the frequency. Right then, you have to ask the question: where is the energy right then? You see.
So when they vector to zero, where's the energy?
When both vectors are zero, then where is the energy? Because right, there's got to be a third field which is carrying the energy at that point in time. You see. Otherwise, there would be no way for the wave to rebuild itself. So there has to be a third field inside a beam of light traveling with this beam of light. It has to be weakly interacting but capable of recreating the electric field vector and the magnetic field vector and moving with the beam of light. Otherwise, once the electric field and the magnetic field both fell to zero, the energy would dissipate. Physicists like to cover all that, not with mathematics or science. They switch to what I call magical reasoning. that's the uncertainty principle. They say, the uncertainty principle says, well, you can't know. Well, the equation says you can know, the fact that we have really good, that we have nanotubes and tubes working at the atomic scale and stuff shows that the uncertainty principle isn't reality. It was just something that Einstein and his buddies, and Heisenberg and those guys were using when they were doing their mathematics in the 1920s and the 1930s, just because they were trying to do mathematics and advance the study of physics before they knew what all the parts were, you see. But they lost the vision. These mathematical tools that helped them when they were writing equations on the chalkboard, they made the mistake of thinking that they were dealing with reality. You know, that time, an equation showing time slowing down, pretending that's reality. Instead of just that's how my mathematics are, and when we know more about physics, we'll know what really happens.
Well, one of the things that I've said, and another thing I take a little bit of heat for, and nothing vicious, but I get some email. I have said that not only are there no laws of physics, that whenever you take a look at this theory of relativity, it's all out of whack. Because space is expanding, the universe is expanding, and it's expanding at the same rate whether you're standing on the Earth or moving through that universe at the speed of light. So regardless of your speed, the universe expands at the same rate, no matter how fast you travel through it. Therefore, if time, space are connected, there can't be that relativity.
I agree with you. Yes, I'll give you. There's so many ways that physicists should be able to see that relativity is not reality. You'll see in book four. When I was describing the night that I was talking to the teacher. And the tall white lady, whose CIA name was a teacher, and I was certain that she and Range 4 Harry had gone to another solar system and returned.
Charles, we have a break that's taking over right as I speak. So we'll pick up right there with Range 4 Harry and the teacher when we come back from this break. All right, folks, more with Charles Hall right after this. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Charles Hall. So, Charles, you were telling us about a conversation with the teacher in Range 4, Harry. Let's pick up there and move forward.
I was certain that they had been to another solar system on kind of their version of a business trip or a relaxing business trip, and they'd return, and when they'd returned, they had been gone only 2.5 months. And I remember one night I was talking with the teacher, and I found it surprising that they had gotten gone somewhere. I wasn't sure where, but I was certain that it was to another solar system, to one of their bases on another solar system, closer in to their home planet and back. And since they'd only been gone 2.5 months, I asked her, I noted that the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, which is really 3 stars, was more than 3.5 light years away. And so I found it surprising that they were able to go there and return in just 2.5 months, because in those days I still believed in Einstein. And I said, you know, I thought Einstein proved that it isn't possible to travel faster than the speed of light. And she and Range 4 Harry were laughing so hard that they were actually rolling on the ground. The tall whites, when they really started laughing, they were more willing to, you know, to physically lay down on the ground and just laugh and laugh than a human might be. And the two of them must have spent a good 10 minutes or better just laughing. And when she got up, I remember she was still kind of laughing and wiping the tears from her eyes, because they did that when they laughed. And she said, well, as you can see, we're here now. And that was one of the first times that it really struck me that relativity wasn't just a little bit wrong. It was hopelessly incorrect.
Well, you know, the universe did not attend the same universities as the PhDs.
Yeah, and see, it should have been, it should be so obvious to a physicist that there are more force fields inside a beam of light by looking at, by just thinking carefully about what happens during, when light waves interfere with each other. Consider, for example, a typical experiment, Young's double slit experiment, where you simply take a piece of glass or a thin film, and you make 2 long slits on it, parallel, and then you let it shine a beam of light on the 2 slits, and let the result after the light passes through the 2 slits, fall on a screen, on a viewing screen, and when the slit, when you do it with a well-made slit and 2 narrow slits, you'll get an interference pattern. If you do it with the red light of a laser, you'll get the interference pattern will just be alternating bands of red light or dark light. Well, the 2 slits can be surprisingly far apart. You know, they can be like 4 inches apart. Well, the wavelength of red light is about the same as the diameter of a single hydrogen atom. When you have 2 slits on a piece of glass, even if they're close together like an inch apart, the number of atoms between those 2 slits is an incredibly large number. It's like Avogadro's numbers, like it's a number like 10^23. You know, Avogadro's number is 6.02 × 10^23. Well, that experiment works even if the light is so dim that mathematically there's only 1 photon of light in the apparatus at a time. And yet, and yet the wavelength of light is only supposed to be the width of a hydrogen atom. Well, but the color of the light doesn't change, you see. Well, the wavelength of a single photon of light isn't anywhere near big enough to cover both slits. On the other hand, the color of the light doesn't change, which means that the usual experiment be right. Because if the wavelength, if the peak of one wave, of a photon, you know, if the peak of one of those electric field vectors was adding on to the peak of the electric field vector from another beam of light, then the new beam of light would have twice the energy. It wouldn't be red light anymore. It would be blue light. Blue light has about twice the energy of red light. The energy, the color would change, you see. When you do the experiment, no energy is lost or gained in Young's double-slit experiment. And the color of the light doesn't change. It means that whatever it is that's doing the, whatever it is that's controlling, whatever it is that's happening in the apparatus, is that there has to be a third field which is steering the electromagnetic portion of the light. The third field has to be a steering field. And it has to be weakly interacting, because the beam of light is only turned in its path without being absorbed or recreated. It's simply being, you know, going through the path one way and turned. And, you know, some photons are turned in one direction and some are turned in a slightly different direction. So the third field must be steering the beam of light. And in order to do that, it must be communicating internally with itself at speeds much faster than light itself.
So it would have to be, or it couldn't communicate with itself.
Yeah.
It would outrun itself.
Yeah, it has to have a working clock, and it must be using a much faster velocity to do that communication. And there goes relativity, you know.
All right, well, now let me ask a question about this third field here. Is that the field that has to be manipulated in order to travel at or beyond the speed of light?
Maybe. There's at least, as Hall photon theory describes in the appendix of books 4, when you go through the logic carefully, there are at least three other fields that Einstein didn't know about. And I know that when the tall whites would power up their scout craft, they had that standard double hull construction with fiber optics in between the two hulls, and they would run subatomic particles in those fiber optics. And that's where they would get the fields from. And the fiber optics would do the same thing for those fields that an electromagnet does for the magnetic field. They would amplify them. And I know that field that I previously described, where the scout craft would fuzz over, I know that they would never do high-speed maneuvers until they had first powered up that field and the scout craft looked fuzzy. As I describe in Book 4, if they hadn't powered up that field, then they would drive the scout craft like a baby buggy, 25, 30 miles an hour, and they'd be very careful. But when they wanted to do high-speed maneuvering, then they would power up that third field, and that would protect them from the forces of acceleration. And once they were protected from the forces of acceleration, they were now streamlined to travel faster than the speed of light. Yeah,
so maybe it is some sort of manipulation of that third field. Maybe it is a blending or bending or manipulation of that field in conjunction with some of these other fields that you're talking about?
Yes. See, Hall photon theory says that the reason Einstein failed in his grand unification attempt, when he tried to do the grand unification theory, he tried to describe mathematically how the inventory of how energy in a gravity field would interact with energy in an electromagnetic field. And forgive me. Just a little cough. Just a few death rattles there. And worked on that for more than 20 years, and he failed. And physicists always try. The physicists they always tried to pretend that he failed because the math was too difficult or because he was getting old and senile. But see, my Hall Photon theory says the reason he failed is very simple. It's because he didn't have all the pieces of the puzzle. He was trying to do grand unification theory without including more fields. And see, Hall Photon theory says that that energy is easily transmitted, stored and moved in from being stored in one kind of field like an electric field into another kind of field like a gravity field if you have all the fields, and that third field is one of them. And Hall Photon theory says that there are at least two more, and you know and the number of fields and forces is way, way higher than what Einstein thought about. Hall Photon theory says that the reason that subatomic particles can be grouped into classes such as leptons and hadrons and baryons and so on is because each one of those different classes has a quark, a still smaller particle, which is creating the corresponding field. So Hall Photon theory says that for every class that you can find, like baryons or hadrons or so on, there's a quark that's controlling class attendance or group attendance. And that quark is putting out a force field, and that you can store energy in that force field and transfer it, if you follow the rules, two other kinds of energy. And the problem Einstein had was very simple. When an astronomer looks at a nearby galaxy, say like the Andromeda Galaxy, and he lets the light go through a spectroscope so he can tell what elements the galaxy is composed of, He sees the same lines, the same fingerprints of the chemical elements in a nearby galaxy like the Andromeda Galaxy that you see when you look at the sun. He sees those same Fraunhofer lines. But because the Andromeda Galaxy is believed to be approaching us slowly, that whole spectrum is blue shifted. There's two galaxies, the Andromeda Galaxy and another galaxy, that are approaching us, and therefore when you look at their light through a spectrograph, the light is blue shifted. That means that after the light was created, just taking a drink of water.
Yeah, well, this is a fortuitous time for that, because we have a break about to take over here in about 2 seconds. We'll continue with Charles Hall when we come back on the other side of this break, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and to my guest, Charles Hall. One quick announcement that I need to make sure that I make, and that is that the music you hear on tonight's show, in part, is supplied by the independent artists at GarageBand.com and at Music.Podshow.com. Excellent sites. If you like the music, go over there and check out those two sites, GarageBand.com and Music.Podshow.com. Thousands of songs for you to enjoy. All right, Charles, we had to cut you off and because of the break, but I want you to continue.
Yes, we were talking about Hall Photon theory.
Yeah.
And the fact that there are more force fields, And when I was out in the deserts of Nevada, as I described, for example, in Book 2, the day that one of the scout craft suffered a meltdown of some of its coils, during that incident, when the Tall Whites finally got that scout craft to where it could work, where it could lift off the desert and push itself forward, but it wasn't under control very well. When they took that up the valley to the main hangar, they had two other scout craft that were working properly come in alongside, one on each side. And they were using the force fields from the other two scout craft to steer the first scout craft. And that meant that there had to be a force field coming off from those two side craft that could push on the first craft. Now, that's like a reverse gravity, only it probably wasn't the force of gravity that they were using. It was another force. It was not in the electromagnetic force, because there weren't any electrical effects. There weren't any sparks or, my radio, for example, was not fuzzed over or anything. So there have to be more force fields around that are weakly interacting, and some that are strongly interacting. But scientists, when you build an accelerator, a particle accelerator, and you only accelerate charged particles, then what you've done is you've left behind all the particles that might very well be creating these extra force fields, but are not themselves a charged particle. You see that these other force fields that may interact with electricity and magnetism, but are not themselves, but they themselves do not carry an electric charge.
Well, and now this is sort of a which came first.
You don't find them.
This question is sort of like which came first, the chicken or the egg? Are these force fields are they producing and gathering together these photons, or is the gathering of the photons producing the force field? How does that work?
It can work either way, because for every force field, there is an associated way for energy to be stored. And when you're doing something that's using the force field, you're storing energy. I'm sorry, but on the other hand, when you're letting energy out of the energy field, then you're producing the force. For example, consider the interaction between electricity and magnetism. You can have an electric field that moves and creates a magnetic field. Or you can have a magnetic field to move and forces charges to move, although the charge itself is due to a quark that converts the property of electric charge. And see when you sit down to describe mathematically the interaction between those fields, the way James Clerk Maxwell tried to do in 1864, and when he came up with Maxwell's four equations, well, he didn't realize that he was only worried about just two fields, the electric field and the magnetic field. Well, Hall photon theory says that when you add the third field to the mix, then you have to increase Maxwell's equations from four to at least six and maybe eight. And in order to keep track of the inventory, the interaction between, the force fields and the energy fields. Once a person realizes that a photon is really energy oscillating between three fields, not just two, then it's obvious that all that stuff about relativity is nonsense, although it may help the mathematics, but it's certainly not reality. And then once you realize that that there's more than three force, or more, you know, that there's more force fields in nature than Einstein knew about. Well, then all of a sudden, you know, it gives you a whole different perspective on physics. In the Michelson-Morley experiment, for example, that was done in 1887, Einstein could have said that the reason the experiment did not produce the results that Michelson and Morley were expecting is because light has a third force field in it. He could have said that, but he didn't. He instead went to magical reasoning, pretending that the dimensions in the direction of motion were always getting smaller and time was slowing down in a magical way that you could never see. And that, but see, when Michelson-Morley in 1887 did their now famous Michelson-Morley experiment, well, they, you know, they first sat down and predicted what they expected to happen based on the based on Maxwell's equations, which said that light was only two fields, an electric field and a magnetic field, and that light had a very, very small, the piece of light was very, very small, the width of a hydrogen, what we now call the width of a hydrogen atom. And then when it failed, you see, when that experiment failed, they didn't want to go back and say there's more to light than what, and radio waves and all that stuff than what we understand. They wanted to pretend that they knew everything that you'd ever be able to know about light, and they didn't want to change what they thought should happen. See that they didn't want to change. They wanted to pretend that you couldn't add things to the structure of the photon, but really, if the experiment fails, that proves that there was more to the structure of the photon than what they knew about. Einstein could have said there's more to the structure of the photon than what we know about. But he didn't. He instead went off on his magical jaunt with relativity. Well, of course, he was, you know, it made him so famous right away that, you know, later you're going to expect him to get up and say, oh, gee, I was wrong. There's more to the story. Like 20 years later, he's supposed to get up and say, now that we know more about stuff, we should go looking for more fields inside the photon. It's so obvious when you look at some of the major experiments in physics that light has to have a third field, a steering field. Yet physicists have kind of gotten hidebound. They've gotten mired into this ivory, what I call the religion of Einstein. Consider the way eyeglasses work, where you have a lens and you have it nice and smooth and grind it. And you know, all of us who wear eyeglasses, we know that light passing through the glass can be, you know, it changes it, you know, it can be magnified, or, you know, you can...
Right.
Well, Snell, one of the guys that first started making decent eyeglasses, you know, Snell's law for, how light is going to get bent when it enters a glass, that's based on huge, big macro qualities of the glass, on the optical properties, the index of refraction, the index of reflection.
All right, Charles, we have our break coming up here in just a few seconds. Mm-hmm. This may be a good point for us to it's not a good point for us to interrupt you, but since we have to do it, this may be the best point. And we'll come back to the eyeglass example when we come back from the break. Very quickly, let me say that Stan Deo does a seminar where he talks about building these toruses of some type of ceramic material, and then they're wound with coils, and you charge them, and they will bind to each other at a certain distance apart, but they're unstable and spin. But if you add a third one, they stabilize and stop spinning and hold position equidistant. Maybe there's something in that about that third field, force field. We'll be back, folks, right after this. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Charles, before I open the telephone lines, I want you to finish that example you were giving us about the example of the eyeglasses.
Yes. In order for the eyeglasses to work, to bring light to a focus, they have to have a noticeable curvature to them. But this curvature is only apparent on a very large scale. You know, in order to say what the curvature of the glass is, you have to be able to measure on a macro scale, like compare, use distances like inches and stuff. Well, when you talk about the wavelength of red light, as we mentioned, you're talking about the electromagnetic wave. That portion of it is only the width of a single hydrogen atom. Well, glass itself has quite a few different parts to it. Silicon, it's silicon dioxide. But, high-quality glass, the kind you find in eyeglasses, may have a few other atoms peppered in there, like lead or, chromium or so on, to adjust the optical properties of the glass. Well, these are, and when you look at it on the atomic scale, the surface of the glass isn't anywhere close to being smooth on the atomic scale. It's all, even if it's been finely ground and highly polished, for a single photon of light to be approaching a piece of glass is a little bit like a BB approaching a mountain or a range of mountains, because on the atomic scale, the bumps are so large. And then when you say, well, gee, when you put in extra atoms, like, to adjust the optical properties, there may only be like one atom in 100 or whatever of lead, yet the path of light is affected by that change in optical properties. Well, if light was only an electromagnetic wave with that short wavelength, it doesn't have any way of knowing what's up ahead. It doesn't get to bounce around in the glass and, go check things out. The electromagnetic wave is simply too small. There has to be a third field. That third field has to be weakly interacting. But it also has to be of a substantial size. It has to be the coherency length of the photon. The coherency length of the photons coming from the sun, is 30 centimeters long and 18 centimeters wide. Coherency lengths coming from light created by a laser can be anything. You can have longitudinal coherency lengths of like 2 miles in light coming from a laser, but it might only be like, the transverse coherency length might only be like, a narrower coherency length. That third field has to be able to carry a shape, or it has to have other properties than what we usually think of as light. But that third field has to be able to steer the photon. It has to have that quality. When a single photon of light is approaching a lens of, in reading glasses, that third field has to be the one that is big enough to know that the glass is curved. Otherwise, if you tried the same experiment with electrons, say with a real, which were quite small, well, the electrons would never be able to figure out that the glass was curved, and the glass won't bring them to a focus, you see. So the existence of a third field, one that steers the photon, one that stores the energy, when both the electric field vector and the magnetic field vector are physically zero, there has to be an energy oscillation going on between those two fields and the third field. Just for ordinary things that for the ordinary properties of light, like glasses and refraction and stuff like that, to be functioning. And see, Einstein and those guys, they knew that light behaved like that, but they never sat down and thought about it. They thought every field had to be like real strong, and they didn't know that there would be particles like neutrinos that can have very weakly interacting fields, and that you know, when you talk about force fields, well, they can come in any length, you know, or any strength, any, you know, when you're talking about, the structure of a photon, you know, if, you know, they seem to think that everything had to be real tiny and real strongly interacting, and Hall photon theory says that third field has a macro, you know, that is the size of the coherency length for the photon that we're talking, for the particular photon that we're talking about. Once you realize that that third field is there, well, the third field can interact with more things than just electricity and magnetism, and therefore provide a mechanism for energy to be transferred from a gravity field to a electromagnetic field to get for light to be blue shifted coming from the galaxy Andromeda. And of course, that's why light can be red too, because energy can be transferred both ways. Once you realize that the light, that light can gain or lose energy by another process, well, then there's no reason to believe that the universe is actually expanding, you see? Because what you're really looking at when you're looking at the redshift from distant galaxies is that the interacting field has had time to engage in other reaction, other energy transfers, to bleed the energy. You know, the photon of light has lost energy coming to us from wherever it was created, and a weakly interacting field may need time to, for, you know, a very long period of time for that to happen.
All right, so then, according to the Hall photon theory, the universe is not expanding.
There's no evidence that it is, because, you know, when you actually go out and you study galaxies, something like 40% of all galaxies have shown evidence of bumping into other galaxies. Well, if you had an expanding universe, how could that ever happen? And likewise, when you when you go out and you plot the position of galaxies, you know, you, as is well known, it appears that they're on the that they're forming on the surface of what sort of look like large soap bubbles. There's, you know, the soap bubble theory of the universe, and that when you plot, you know, them in three dimensions, that they're not actually evenly distributed. They move in big groups. There's like something called the Great Wall, and so on. And I'm sorry, for all that to happen, you got to have more force fields. You have to have the third force field that we've described in light. You have to have a anti-gravity force field to push as well as pull, so gravity can push as well as pull, or a force like gravity that works at a very long range. And of course, anytime you talk about a force field for real, that force field has to be able to store energy and release it. So now all of a sudden you have a mechanism for what physicists call dark energy, which right at the minute they say, oh, it's magical, and my answer is nonsense. It's not magical. It's that there's more force fields in it. You're storing energy in those force fields. An example of how silly physicists are is on dark matter and dark energy, mm-hmm. where they're trying not to just stand up and say Einstein was wrong. They're trying to say, oh, space itself is breaking down. Maybe it's going to another dimension. My answer is nonsense. What is a dimension? A dimension is just another way of storing energy and releasing energy. So the electric field would be one dimension. The magnetic field would be a different dimension. There are different ways of storing energy. So anytime you say, well, gee, anytime you start talking about dark energy or dark matter or dark forces or any of that stuff, what you're really talking about, what you're really saying is that in order to describe what is happening, you can't do it with just the four force fields that Einstein knew about.
I think would be one reason he was not able to come up with his unified field theory.
Exactly.
Is because he was missing force fields.
Exactly. See, physicists today are standing up and saying something that's contradictory, and then we're all supposed to believe it because isn't physics wonderful? They'll get up and say all processes can be explained using just four force fields. Then when you go out and you measure the rotation of galaxies and all sorts of things, they'll say, oh, there's all sorts of things that can't be explained using those four force fields. So then instead of saying there must be more force fields, which would prove Einstein wrong, and there goes relativity, then they say, oh, that must be some magical interaction with space, or, you know, or the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you know. So there's a lot of physicists that, in my humble opinion, are doing for the science of physics what Henley did to Enron.
Okay.
Motivated by money and power, not really motivated by a desire to, to know the truth.
All right, I tell you what we need to do. We're going to open up the telephone line so people can call in. And as we do that, I want to remind once again, and the notice is now on screen on our internet TV channel. So if you're watching, you can see it. If you're not watching, listen up. Everyone is free to call, but if you want to call a prank call in and be part of this little group that has now been painted into a corner, you call your prank call in. Understand that you, by calling here, are agreeing that it's okay for us to put your telephone number right up on the screen, and we will do it. And so if you want to be famous, just try to, harass this worldwide audience some more and take them on. That's who you're taking on. You're taking on the world. If you're up to it, we'll make you famous. The telephone number is 806-605-4461, and the telephone line is open. 1-800-605-4461. Now, in something you said earlier, I jotted down a question because I wanted to come back to it. You were talking about when you were in the Air Force and you were a weather observer, and you didn't say you were at Indian Springs, but you have said it before. You said tonight I was out in Nevada, and the you observed when they would power up their craft, and you were talking about this group of extraterrestrials that you've called the Tall Whites, and you referred to the teacher and Range 4 Harry. But you said that you were certain that they had been to another solar system. And I jotted the question down. Why were you certain they had been to another solar system?
It was just based on my friendship with them. While they were gone, as I describe in Book 4, you remember in my books, I'm trying to capture the emotion of how it felt to live that day by day. The Tall White I call the New Guard had said that they were on a trip and they would be back, and the teacher and at Range 4 Harry had said that they were, the teacher especially had said that she was looking forward to taking Pamela, the Tall White lady called Pamela, back closer in towards their home planet. Pamela had never been to their home planet. They were talking about it the same way that, say, like my daughters might be talking about looking forward to going to we live in New Mexico, to going to New York City to go shopping. You know, they were talking about, going back, in that sense, it was going to be like a happy business trip for them. They never came to teach me anything, and so they were real sketchy about where that was. It's my understanding that it was the star Arcturus, but I could be wrong. And it certainly wasn't any of the planets in our solar system, because I'm certain that the Earth was the only planet in our solar system where they had a base. And I'm also certain that it was a substantial distance away, they were going back to their culture and like you and I might go to Washington D.C. and talk to some government officials, and they were doing the equivalent of that in their culture. And then while they were on that business trip, they were also going to have fun and go shopping and you know, relax and enjoy themselves. And so I'm certain that it wasn't in this solar system, but I don't know exactly where it was.
Now, when you were...
That was just based on our friendship, you know.
Yeah. Now, when you were observing them, you were obviously noticing some things scientifically. And did they ever pick up on that? Did they ever notice that you were doing that?
They didn't care. That's what you remember. You remember that when the committee, which was the Tall Whites and the American Generals, decided that I would be given those special orders, that I could go anywhere I wanted, the day or night in Dreamland, and that nothing I did would ever be classified, but that nobody could ever ask me questions. They were well aware that in the course of me watching them and them watching me, or you know, in the course of forming a bond of friendship, that we would get to know each other and see. From the point of view of the American generals and the Tall Whites, the only way that both sides could trust each other is if there were a group of people like myself and the teacher who were friends outside of the government framework. And I'm certain the generals think that way. Remember when Nixon went to China and when Nixon was president. Afterwards, remember that the press asked one of the generals if America and China were now going to have treaties if we now trusted China. And the general, and he was a four-star general, remember the general said, and I paraphrase, but I post-paraphrase, he said that the problem with making treaties with China in the days of the Nixon administration was that there did not exist a group of people in America and in China who were naturally friends with each other outside of the government framework. And he defined that to be a requirement for two nations to trust each other. And by comparison, and these are my words, if we consider England, well, there's, you know, a whole bunch of people who have, you know, Americans who have friends in England and English people who have friends in America, totally outside of a government or a military framework. And so if the American government or the English government or the government of Great Britain, if they did something silly, if one of the politicians slipped up or whatever, that group of people could maintain the communication, say, boy, aren't our leaders silly, and get things back on track, see? And that was one of the things the generals and the Tall Whites were hoping to establish. And therefore, the Tall Whites and the American generals, not only did they not care, but they were quite happy if the teacher and I and Range 4 Harry were friends and just went out and talked with each other.
Did you ever ask any?
Excuse me. Yeah.
Did you ever ask any questions of these extraterrestrials that were of a technical nature? And if so, what were they and what did they answer?
The Tall White, yes, I did ask questions, but what not the Tall Whites would answer them was a good question. The Tall Whites, see, never came to teach me anything. They came for their purposes. And therefore, their willingness to answer questions was they were only willing to answer questions if there was some benefit to them to answering my question. Making me happy, they did not see as a benefit. They might just come and let the kids play and leave and never say anything at all. There had to be some reason in it for them. For example, as I describe in Book 3, the day they stopped me on the Range 4 road. Well, the day before, me and my friend who at Indian Springs, who was in petroleum oils and liquids, one of my friends, he had been out Range 3 talking with me. And he knew they were out there, and he knew they were real. He had seen them at Range 4, and he had also seen them out at Range 3. And it was his belief that they must be dangerous mutants, that they must be monsters, or you know, that they must. That, and he was explaining to me his view that I shouldn't let the teacher and the teacher bring the children around, because that would be like, you know, allowing monsters to come and play where I was. And the 12-lights, and I didn't agree with him. I said, no, you really don't understand. They're just nice people like you and I are. They just don't happen to be human. And the 12-lights must, the teacher must certainly have been monitoring our conversation from the mountains over by the ammunition bunker, even though at the time it seemed like my friend and I were alone. Well, see, the next day, when we were coming back from Range 4, as I described, Book 3, and they let the fuel truck go on ahead and stopped my truck on the Range 4 road, and came and got me out of my truck in a pleasant manner, and took me on board the scout craft as it sat there, and just showed me the inside of the scout craft. The teacher was showing me the council that she was so proud of, where she put on her makeup and dressed up to look human and so on. Their purpose was to show me that they weren't monsters, that they really were just ordinary people like you and me and, you know, the other humans. They happened to have come from another star.
So, Charles, we need to take some phone calls. I hate to break into the story. We can come back to it, but I've got some folks holding, and I want to bring them on. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. Okay.
Oh, hello.
Yes, your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, my name is James, and I'm calling from New York.
Yes, James.
I have a question about, like, phenomenons that happen with UFO sightings.
Okay.
When I was skiing over in Utah, right, I saw this ball of light coming out, right, and it was just amazing. It was really big, and it seemed to be coming closer and closer. As that happened, it seemed as though...
Okay, James, you're going to hang on. A break just took over. You want to hang on through the break?
Yeah, I'll hang on.
All right, hang on. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I guess James had second thoughts, and that's what he needed to have. We won't put his number up because he didn't pull anything nonsensical on air. Wise choice, James, a wise choice. All right, to the phone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Well, Kevin, you know I'm not all there either, eh? But I'm still here anyway. It's Kevin from Iroquois Falls, Ontario.
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
Hello, Charles. I wanted to know, the tall whites that you made friends with, did they ever have any interactions with other extraterrestrial beings, such as the Greys or the Anunnaki?
It's my understanding that the Greys and the tall whites are natural enemies. And when I talked with the tall whites, remembering that it was never their intention to tell me anything unless it was to their advantage. And so the only time they ever mentioned other types of extraterrestrials was the night I described in Book 3, when I asked the teacher what humans were like as compared with, were there other other planets out there and around other stars that were inhabited by intelligent life, and that was one of the few times she gave me a straight answer. You know, I was asked how we compared, and her feeling, her reason for answering appeared to be because she really liked bringing the children to play where I was. I had these pretty colored balloons, and the children loved to play where I was. And she was just trying to maintain a happy playground for the kid. And that's where, as I describe in book three, she said that there were quite a few such planets, but that the but that humans were different in that, in the way we interacted with animals. And you can see the rest in book three. And also in book four, when I would, when I was listening to the tall whites talking with, there was the tall white would refer to a group of Earth-like planets that did not have intelligent life on them, implying that there were a group that did.
All right. The telephone number is 1-800-605-4461. 1-800-605-4461. And let's go to the telephone. And, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Joe, New York.
I'm sorry, this is who?
Joe from New York.
Yeah, Joe.
So I have a story for you.
Okay.
I got abducted by aliens last week.
When you were three. And what happened?
They cut me open.
And they did what?
They took out my heart and showed it to me.
Are you serious?
I am.
And what else happened, Joe?
They put this endoplasmic goo all over me and sealed me back up and then teleported me back to Earth.
Uh-huh. And where are we headed with the story?
I just thought it was an interesting story to tell.
Uh-huh. Have you told this to anybody else?
No, I have not.
How do you feel about it all?
I don't know. It's kind of in the back of my mind right now, but I kind of forgot about it. It happened last week.
Which aliens picked you up? What did they look like?
They were big blacks. They were big black and small white eyes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for the call. All right. The telephone number is 1-800-605-4461. Charles, have you ever heard of a species of extraterrestrials that are tall and black?
No, I have not. I can't make any statement because I've never heard of that before, you know, that call. And, you know, for me to say anything, I'd just be speculating.
All right, let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, I'm calling from Alaska. Anchorage.
Uh-huh. Your first name?
Oh, I'm calling from Anchorage.
All right. Let's give this one a try. And, well, let's see. I'm trying to bring that one online. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Rex from Miami.
Yes, Rex.
Yeah, I have a couple questions for Charles.
All right.
I was wondering if the tall whites are still in Nevada today, as far as he knows.
The last time that I personally saw them was in May of 67, before I went to Vietnam. However, in book four, we have several credible updates that suggest that they are still there. Their main hangar was, you know, up in Area 54, and their underground living quarters up in Area 53. They were dug into that mountain, and their landing field over Dogbone Lake was such a natural place for them to come in that I feel certain that they're still up there in Nevada. Remember that they also had 5 or 7 scout craft hangars around in both in the valley of Dogbone Lake and off in French Peak. And because the security zones and stuff haven't changed, it is my personal belief that they're still there. Of course, the U.S. government uses areas over in Utah, areas 70 and 75 over in Utah, to support the moon base, the 2 moon bases that America, that I believe America has on the moon. And so I could also believe that the Tall Whites, you know, had scout craft bases or had activities over in Utah, over in the in those areas. But and of course the scout craft were such high performance. The scout craft, you know, the scout craft, their technology, could, you know, they could make the crossing from the Earth to the Moon in 10 or 15 minutes, and you know, so it shows how with their scout craft they could go all over the Earth and literally from here to Mars in just a couple, you know, in just a very short time. The scout craft could reasonably be taken to 10% the speed of light. The technology would have allowed the scout craft to exceed the speed of light, but Range 4 Harry, when I asked him about that, he was quite explicit that he didn't think the scout craft was built well enough to ever risk taking it that fast. But going to 5 or 10% the speed of light was something that he felt comfortable doing. And, you know, at those kinds of speeds, you could make the crossing from here to the moon in 10, 15 minutes, from here to Mars in an hour or so. You could go anywhere you wanted in the Earth. One day.
Okay, well, let me check with the caller for a moment. Caller, did you have another question?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering if, I don't know what your current job is, but do you have a chance to do experimentation in physics to test out your theories or... further advance them?
My current position, is a highly classified, and I don't want to say what I'm doing, but I'm not experimenting in physics right at the minute. I'm not building anything, or I don't have anything I'm constructing in the garage or anything like that. You know, and when I came off the ranges, I came off with just my memories. So I'm not actually building anything right at the minute.
Okay, one question I have for you. Caller, what did you say your name is?
Yeah, Rex from Miami.
Yeah, Rex, are you a first-time caller?
No, I've called in, I think, a couple times.
Okay, I just didn't recognize the voice. All right. I appreciate the call, and thanks for 2 excellent questions.
Okay, thanks.
All right, folks. The telephone number is open, and it is 1-800-605-4461. 1-800-605-4461. I don't know why it's working so slowly this evening. But it is, and let me, I'm trying to bring a call up online right now. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
I'm Will from Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay.
Well, I was just got a story, and I have a question. I was in the woods the other day walking my dog, and I thought I saw a large figure, but I couldn't make out what it was. Do you have any idea what it might have been?
No, but I really would recommend that you go back to the forums and discuss in the forums whether you can get away with this, because if I label this as a prank call, I'm going to make you famous.
What are you talking about?
Okay. Have a good day. All right. 1-800-605-4461. 1-800-605-4461. It is toll-free. And open to anybody. As I say, you know, if you want to roll the dice and, you know, you feel like, you know, you feel lucky to make a prank call, well, go ahead. You're agreeing to have your telephone number put right up on the screen for a worldwide audience to know. It's not, you know, it's your telephone number. It's your caller ID stuff. You know, your name, your telephone number, you want that on the screen? You got it, baby. All right, let's go back to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. All right. Let's see if we can bring this call up. Yeah, we're still getting hit with this, and I am truly going to bring it to a conclusion. All right, that's what we've got here. Caller, you're live on the Kevin's. Your first name and from where are you calling? Okay. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? All right. Well, as I anticipated, these guys didn't have enough sense to stop. And so, guess what, guys? You're going to get the whole package. Website and all is going down. Get the audio back up. We're back. My guest is Charles Hall. The telephone number is toll-free in all of the United States. It's toll-free in Canada. And if you're outside of that area, what you can do is just go over to my website and scroll down. It's kevinsmithshow.com. Scroll down. And you'll see a link that says flash message. So if you're not in Canada, if you're not in the USA, you don't want to make that long-distance call, you can use the flash message. But if you're in the USA or Canada, it's a toll-free number. Unfortunately, Charles, we have to have this little thing going right now because of... some harebrained snowboard surfer dudes. They think it's cool to make prank calls to the show. We identified also a plot against another show, and we are warning the host of the other show. It's a TV show. And we're providing names of the people involved to law enforcement as well. So... you know, all I can say is, you want to be famous, make a prank call to the show, your telephone number goes on the screen, and then the audience can do whatever the audience wants to do. You're agreeing to that if, because I've announced it and it's on the screen, and you're agreeing to that if you call in and make a prank call. All right, Charles, the Tall Whites, you said you think they are probably still... out there in Nevada, right? Okay, well, it would appear that we lost Charles too, so let's get him back on the line here. Yeah, Charles, I don't know what happened. We have this little group of folks that want to play havoc with the show, but you know what they don't understand. You know, they think a bunch of them, not all of them, but a bunch of them are in Canada, and they think, I know they think this because I read their posts, that, well, I'm in Canada, he can't do anything. They should ask Mr. McKinnon, Gary McKinnon, if there is no reach to the law. And they really should research and find out if, in fact, committing a crime in the United States can be prosecuted and they can be extradited and prosecuted in the United States. They can be. And it falls under our anti-terrorism legislation, Homeland Security. It's a group, IC3.gov is where you report it. And so anyway, all that's in process. I'm sorry it happened to you on this show. I apologize for that.
I understand totally, and my interpretation of that is that your show must be very effective because, your show must be reaching a lot of people and doing a lot of wonderful good things for that to be going on.
Yeah, and it is, and of course, it's like a really cool thing to tag such a big show, but it's also a big thing, and I've spent my life in court, and they think I'm afraid to go back. They think I'm afraid to take them, or that I won't. These guys are nuts. That's how I earned my living, was putting people in jail. All right, but let's talk about the tall whites. You said that you think that they are probably still in place out in Nevada.
Yes, Yes, that's correct. I believe that.
All right, and you, in the course of answering that question for that caller, you said that there is a place, I believe you said in Utah, that supports two moon bases. What do you know about that? How do you know about that?
In Nevada, the area numbers go up to 60. There's Area 51 and...
Hello? Well, we have lost Mr. Hall again, but we're still connected, but we've lost his audio. And Charles, if you can hear me, I'm going to hang up the phone, and I'm going to call you back, and we'll see what happens. All right. I apologize, folks. We just have to work our way through these things, and we'll see what we shall see, I guess, once we get everybody in court. And that'll line folks up from here to Los Angeles, and it'll line them up from there to Montreal. That's the only way we can handle it. That's what we'll do, and we'll see what the judges have to say about it. Okay, well, apparently there's some problem on Charles's line. I'm not going to dedicate the rest of this show to talking about this conspiracy against my show, but I would suggest that everyone concerned get in touch with Matt Rich and find out if it's worth it. I also would encourage everyone concerned to check history. Check history and see what attacks against this show result in. I really strongly recommend that you don't follow this course of action. I strongly recommend that you drop it, because what's coming is something you can't handle, believe me. All right, let's see if we can get Charles back on for the last two or three minutes of the show and see what happens here.
Hall resident.
Yes, Charles, I don't know what happened. We lost your audio.
I don't know what happened on this end either. But the line went dead, and I wasn't able to, I wasn't able to hear you either.
Yeah.
But as I was saying in answer to your question, question. The in Nevada, the area numbers go up to 60, and over in Utah, the area numbers 70 through 75. They're up in that northeastern quadrant, and areas 70 and 75 are the ones that support the moon bases. And there's at least two moon bases. There's one on this side of the moon and one on the, just around the limb on the far side of the moon. Willie Ley back in 1946 wrote a book that was in effect laid out the strategy. He said when he was trying to decide when he was analyzing that. And see, the reason you need a base on this side of the moon is so that you can receive supplies and communicate with the Earth and so on. But on the other hand, you'd want the military, the military part, to be on the around the limb on the far side of the moon where you can't see it from the Earth. And part of it is because of orbital mechanics. And part of it is because if you had it on the far side of the moon, no one could ever, you would be, from there you would control the inner solar system, space planes and stuff like that coming off the far side of the moon could easily, as well as the near side of the moon, but especially from the far side of the moon, could easily control, everything from about the orbit of Venus out to the asteroid belt, you see.
Charles, we're just about out of time, and I wish we had time for you to complete that answer, maybe next time. But I want you to tell us again where folks can go to get your books.
At my website, millennialhospitality.com. My email wasn't working for a couple of weeks because I was switching hosting providers, but everything is up and running now, and it's at www.millennialhospitality.com, and my books are much different than my than the information I present on the talk show host. What I tried to do in the book, everything in the books is true, and what I tried to do in the books was to capture the emotion of how I felt when these things were happening to me, how I felt to live day by day those things.
Yeah. And Charles, so, we're out of time, man.
People in the kingdom.
Thanks for being with me. Stay on the phone with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a wrap. My friends call me Steve. My enemies do too, and probably some other things. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.